All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Pachane Nirvasesa Sanyavadi Paskachade Shatani Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Uttama Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sraganat Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raganatam Vitam Stam Sajivam Sadvaitam Sadvajitam Purijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishatam Vitam Stam Namo Bhakti Vinodaya Satchidananda Namane Gora Shakti Srubhaya Vipinodavaniti. So we're looking at the Dasmula Tattva of Bhakti Vinod Thakur. What's very exciting about this Dasmula Tattva is that there aren't very many things where we can say this is absolutely true. In all circumstances, all times and places, to all persons, from all points of view. So this Dasmula Tattva, this is what we're understanding to be the absolute truth. Other things you may find, well, it could be seen this way, it could be seen that way, this person has that angle, this person has the other angle. Now, I haven't memorized this sloka as Shravan Prabhu has done, so I'm going to read through it, and I'm sure I will mangle it. I was practicing it, and I thought, while I'm reading this, Shravan's going to be going, oh, God.
He's used to the rest of us.
He's used to it, huh? Anaya praha tatvam harim iha paramam sarva shaktim masadvim tad binam samscha jivan prakriti kalalitam tad vimuktam shabhavat veda veda prakasam Sakalam api hare sananam shuddha bhaktim sadyam tat pratim etyu padishati janam gora chandra swayam saha. So I'm going to just go through the whole list, which wouldn't hurt to do each time. So the first truth is that where we get our source of knowledge, which Shravan Prabhu already talked about, which is the Shastra. The Shastra is our ultimate source of knowledge. Obviously, we gain knowledge through our senses. Have to. Shastra doesn't tell us now the light's green, you can cross the street. Not, should I cross the street right now? Let me look it up in the Bhagavatam. So we have our senses. And then we also have logic. Again, you also have to use some logic. And in fact, even when you're reading the scriptures, you're using your mind and your senses to read the scriptures. But we don't consider that any of those are absolute sources of knowledge. Even the empiricists don't think they're absolute sources of knowledge. The only absolute source of knowledge is Shabda, is that coming from Krishna. Then what do we learn? So the next nine truths are what we learn. So we learn that Sri Hari is the supreme absolute truth, with Gopa Vrinda Prabhupada, who spoke about last week. Unfortunately, I was on the other side of the island. What we'll speak about tonight, Sarva Shaktiman, that he's omnipotent, that he's not impotent. The third one, Akila Rasa Mrita Sindhu. He's the shoreless ocean of unlimited nectarian mellows. Then Vivinamsa Tattva, the entire range of liberated and conditioned jivas are Srihari's eternally separated parts and parcels. Then Bhada Jiva, the conditioned jiva is infected by Maya. Mukta Jiva, the liberated jiva is free from Maya. Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva, all creation, either material or spiritual, is a manifestation of Srihari's inconceivable potency, which is simultaneously different and non-different from the Lord. Shuddha Bhakti is the only sadhana, and Krishna Priti, Krishna Prema, is the only goal. So we have first a description of basic knowledge. Who's God? Who am I? What are the energies? Then what do you do to achieve God? And then what is the goal? So where do you get your knowledge from? What do we know? What's our sambandha? Then what's our process? Abhideya? What's our prayojana? So now we're at the second tattva of sambandha. What is true? So there's also a verse for this, which I had even harder time with the other one. There's a specific verse for each of these truths. So there's one master verse that that has all of them listed in a short suture form, and then each of the tattvas also has an expanded one. Prayakaya Shaktir Apritag Apisaswe Mahi 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 Mani Stito Jivakyam Swa Achid Abhihitam Tam Tripadikam Swatan Trecha Shaktim Sakala Vishaya Prerana Paro Vikaradyai Shuna Padama Purusho Sho Vijayate. The Supreme Lord is non-different and inseparable from his inconceivable absolute potencies, and yet he is totally independent. He eternally embodies unlimited majestic grandeur. He always inspires his divine potencies, known as the Parashakti, consisting of the Jiva Shakti, the marginal potency, the Chit Shakti, the internal spiritual potency, and the Maya Shakti, the external illusory potency, to engage in worthwhile activities. Yet he, the highest absolute truth, eternally existent with full divinity, the supreme personality of Godhead, remains unaffected and unchanged. So a little bit of a challenge, actually, to speak on these, because these truths are all interrelated. And so as I started to prepare for this, all of a sudden I think, wait a minute, now I'm talking about Achintabheda Beta Tattva. Uh-oh, now I'm talking about Jiva Shakti. And so it was very hard to really stay just kind of razor sharp focused. That this truth is that God has energies. Now, if God doesn't have energies, he's not a person. And if you're a person, you have energies. We can say that Krishna understood as the Brahman, Brahmeti, Bhagavaniti, Paramatmiti, Subjati, is not manifesting energies. But sometimes we say that you can't really even say that. You can't really even say that as Brahman there's no energies. It really means that your vision is clouded, so you don't see the energies, therefore you only see God as Brahman. I'd like for us to think first about our energies. So the other day I took the kids to the library and there was an exhibition about meteorites. The person giving the presentation asked a question. Why, if meteorites have an equal rate of falling all over the world, are the 90% of them found either in the Sahara Desert or in Antarctica? So a couple people gave some ideas, and then I thought, I wonder if what he's saying is really this. I asked a question, and he said, yes, that's what I'm saying. And then I was immediately able to give the answer. And I felt very proud and happy of my energy of knowledge. That, yes, I understood that. So we can all think of experiences like that, right? You cook something, and you look at it, and you say, look at this creative energy that I've done. Or you understand something, and you say, wow, look at this energy of intelligence I have. Or look at this. We have different energies to do different things. I mean, even just driving a car. And you take some pleasure, isn't it? That you can manipulate the machine, and you can turn this way and that way. Well, Krishna also feels like that, by the way. And in the story of killing Agasura, remember when all the cowherd boys went into Agasura's mouth? And Krishna didn't know what to do? Because he thought, well, if I just kill this demon, all my friends are inside him, they'll also die. And I want to save them but I want to kill the demon, and how do I do it? And while he was thinking about how to do this, it says in Bhagavatam that he was thinking, wow, my illusory energy is really nice. What an energy I have. And in the 20th chapter, the description of autumn, actually, first it describes the rainy season, then autumn. And as the rainy season is being described, it also says that Krishna was meditating on his internal energy that manifests Vrindavan. And he was thinking, the word there in the Bhagavatam is pujayam. He was almost worshipping his own energy, his own internal energy. And Prabhupada translates it in Krishna book as proud. That Krishna was proud. Just see my internal. Look what I've done. Look at my internal energy. How wonderful. It's working. So we have some sense of what that is. Right? You set up this room. I remember Gopal was speaking the other day about how when they bought this place, right, you just walked on the floor and you went through it and it's fixed up and you look at the place and you say, yes, by our energy, our design energy, our picking out the paint, our doing this, it's come together. So Krishna delights in his energies. He's proud of his energies. Not arrogant proud, but he's proud of his energies. He's worshiping his energies. He's delighting in his energies, just like we do. Of course, so-called our energies are actually coming from Krishna. the main point here is that Krishna is not impotent. He's not an impotent God. Now, many people have this idea of God as impotent. That, well, you know, probably there's no God. And if there is a God, he just sort of, you know, created the watchmaker. He wound it up, he created it, and then he can't really do anything. There was a whole book on this topic written by a rabbi, supposedly a religious leader, where he was saying, you know, why do bad things happen to good people? And his conclusion is God is impotent. He's a nice guy, but there's just nothing he can do about it. He's just kind of wringing his hands, oh, I'm suffering so much and I can't do anything. And a lot of Christians have a similar theology. They really posit that there's two gods. There's God and then there's the devil. And it's the devil who's responsible for the tsunamis and the cancer. And again, God is kind of looking on from the sidelines and going, well, what am I going to do about this? How am I going to deal with this? So many times people don't have an understanding of God as being potent, especially the Mayavadis. And if you really want to read the arguments, I suggest you go to Chaitanya Charitamrita Adi Lila, chapter 7. It starts about verse 100, where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu went to see Prakasananda Sarasvati and all of his disciples. And the Lord sat down where people washed their feet. You know, it's not a very clean place, but he was manifesting the brilliance of Narayana. Prakasananda Sarasvati did some of the Supichi by pulling him up. And they were asking Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to speak about Vedanta Sutra. And he said, the problem is that the commentary of Sankaracharya is criticizing Vyasadeva, saying Vyasadeva is wrong. Sankaracharya is claiming that Vyasadeva says that the Lord has transformed himself into the world, and therefore he can't exist anymore as the Lord. Kind of like, you know, if you have a child, what that would mean is you took one of your fingers and you like turned it into a child and now you don't have a finger anymore. You know, my poor Nietzsche wouldn't only have two fingers left. Right? If every time you created something, you know, you create a picture and then there's like some chunk is missing from your arm. So the Sankaracharya was positing this idea that Brahman transforms itself into the world. And he says, well, this can't be true. It can't be true because then Brahman wouldn't be non-dual and wouldn't be changeless. And therefore, the world doesn't exist at all. It just doesn't exist. I remember before I started practicing Krishna consciousness, seeing one Star Trek episode like this, very much informed by Buddhism and impersonalism, where the members of the spaceship, they were on some weird planet that created an illusion of things. And all they had to do was just say, it's not real, 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 it's not real. It's not real. You know, it went away. So that's Buddhist philosophy. Buddhist philosophy, by the way, is becoming very dominant in the Western countries. It's quite interesting. I'm doing some research for ISKCON management about how we can help our preaching to respond to what's going on in the world. So I was looking at a number of business manuals, and one was done by top business advisors who've become Buddhists. And their whole way of managing business was based on the idea that we're all one. And I was thinking we should ultimately come up with a Vaishnava philosophy of doing business, right, instead of something either secular or Buddhist. But anyway, that's Sankaracharya's idea, that therefore, because God can't have transformed himself in the world, this world doesn't exist at all. It's not that it's something else than it appears to be, but it just isn't even there. And we're not even here as individuals. That God has no potencies, he has no energies, he's just diffusion of being. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, no, it's not that God is transformed, it's that his energies are transformed. So this again is a very easy thing to understand. So my youngest son, Keshava, called me today. He says, hey, Mata, we're at the Rath Yatra in L.A., and as we're walking through the festival, we heard your voice. So we thought about you and thought we'd give you a call. Oh, what was it? Oh, someone was playing a video of you. Probably my Prabhupada Memories videos. They're probably trying to sell the DVDs. So that's a transformed energy. And Prabhupada gives this example a lot, that you can play a recording of him. Maya tatamidam sarvam jagat avyaktimurtinam matstani sarvabhutani natjaham te shravastitaha. I'm not there. So there's my separated, transformed energies are there in Los Angeles. But you know what? I'm not there. But I am there. But I'm not there. So that's a transformation of my energy. Or, you know, Shravan's worked hard to fix up this place. That's a transformation of his energy. He's transformed his energy into a floor and into a painting. Like, you know, or the people cooking the offering, they transform their energy into the food. So that's a very easy thing to understand. So if I can do that, why can't God do that? And when I do that, nothing, I don't lose something. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnat Udachate Purnasya Purnam Adaya Purnam Eva Vasishchate. You take, this is complete, that is complete, you take the complete away from the complete, still the complete remains. Now this is all very important to us because guess what we are? We're one of Krishna's energies. So this isn't some theoretical discussion, some what we call armchair philosophy. Oh, I wonder what God is. Is he omnipotent or is he impotent? Is the world real or is it unreal? It's not like that. It directly affects our lives. I mean, first of all, it directly affects our lives if the world is real or not. It directly affects our life if I'm real or not. I mean, that's slightly consequential. Do I actually exist? Who am I? And then who am I? So understanding that God has unlimited energies, Prastha Shakti or Vividaya Suyute, that's sort of the core verse. I'm one of those energies. All right, let's look at some other of Krishna's energies. And then we're going to look at how we can use this knowledge of Krishna's energies to transform our lives. Now, Krishna has unlimited energies. One place where Prabhupada was speaking about this, he said, like, the particular potency or energy to do a painting, it's a particular kind of energy. And to do all sorts of different things, you need different kinds of energies, like the way you sing. That's a particular kind of energy. But because Krishna can do everything, he has all different kinds of energies. And if you look at the paper that I handed out to you, on the bottom, this is not the only place where this is quoted, but one of my favorite. This is from the Lord Brahma's prayers to Krishna after Krishna manifests as all the cowherd boys and all of the calves, and then manifests as Vishnu forms. And when the Lord is manifest as all the Vishnu forms, he's surrounded by many, many, many living entities. And each of those living entities are serving him according to their own qualities. So the conditioned living entities are serving him according to their particular modes of material nature and their particular talents, and the liberated living entities are serving him according to their particular rasa. So in the commentary there, Sanatana Goswami explains that Krishna has unlimited qualities, unlimited potencies, and he also has unlimited jivas. And for each living entity, there's one particular potency or energy of quality of the Lord that especially attracts us. So there's a match between each of us as individuals and some particular energy of Krishna. That's how many different nuances of energies that he has. And looking at the chart here, this was taken from Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about Dasmula Tattva in two places. One is in Jaya Dharma, and the other is an essay called Dasmula Tattva. So this is taken from the essay. And if you take a look at this in the upper left corner, Swarup Shakti, who's Radharani, ultimately Krishna's energy is one. It's his Swarup. Swa means oneself, Rup means form. The energy of his own self, which is Srimati Radharani. Then that energy has three divisions. It has actually two sets of three divisions which interrelate with one another. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains how these two sets of three are related to each other. So one set of three is that Krishna has his internal, external, and marginal energies. I'm sure everybody here is familiar with that. So though he has unlimited energies, unlimited nuances and energies, you can classify them into those three. You can say these are the three main categories into which all of these little individual energies come. So the chit-shakti is the internal energy, that which manifests the spiritual world. The marginal energy, that's you and me and each of us. And the external energy, that is the energy of illusion, the energy of darkness, the energy of bewilderment. Then you can also divide them into three in terms of Sandini, Samvit, and Haladini. So Sandini is like the energy of existence. We also say Satchidananda. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this is the energy of bala, of strength, of power. Then there's the energy of Samvit, of knowledge, of gyan. Then the energy of Ladini, of happiness, which also he says is the energy of Kriya. And he's quoting the Svetasvara Upanishad for this understanding. Why Kriya? Because in order to have happiness, you have to do something. It's pretty hard to have happiness doing nothing. That's called boredom. I remember when I was in high school, one of my classmates said, "Hey, have you ever spent a day doing nothing?" I said, "I don't think so." He said, "That's because you don't smoke." And I said, "Well, if you're smoking, that's doing something." I said, "How do you be happy doing nothing?" Not possible. All right, now these each relate to each other. So the Sandini, or the Bala Shakti, when it's manifest in the spiritual, the Chit Shakti, it's fully manifest. And it's manifest there as the spiritual qualities, the objects in the spiritual world, the houses, the trees, the land, everything that assists in the Lord's pastime, and Krishna's form, name, qualities, and pastimes are all manifestations of the Sandini Shakti. And by the way, I spelled it wrong. There's an H after the D. There's supposed to be H after the D. Sorry. When the Sandini Shakti manifests in the Jiva Shakti, that's us, it manifests in a minute form, not in its full form, and it manifests as our spiritual name, our spiritual form, and our spiritual existence. Bhaktivinoda Thakur also delineates in Jiva Dharma, there's 11 aspects of our identity. We each have an eternal form, an eternal age, eternal relationship with Krishna, a supreme goal, a residence, a group that we belong to, and so forth. So we each have our everything. We have our furniture, our jewelry, anayana busha. We even have our own ornaments and our own clothing. So all that's manifested by the Sandini Shakti. Like it manifests Krishna's name and form and quality, also manifests ours. When the Sandini Shakti is manifest in Maya, or the external potency, it's manifest as a reflection. So it's manifest in the Chit Shakti in full, in the Jiva Shakti minutely, in the Maya Shakti as a reflection. And in the Maya Shakti, it manifests as the material universes, the planets, the sun, the moon, the stars, the meteorites, the asteroid belt, our gross and subtle body. So my spiritual form is manifested when the Sandini Shakti comes to me, the Jiva, and when the Sandini Shakti comes to my, it manifests my this blood and bones and that kind of thing, and my mind, also my material mind, intelligence, false ego, also material goals. I want to be a doctor, I want to go to heaven, I want to explore the depths of the ocean, I want to make a lot of money, I want to clean my house. So that's all manifestation of Sandini Shakti hitting the Maya Shakti. So our material name and form and qualities, you know, Sam Smith, 5'10", 150 pounds, strong, asthmatic, whatever. So that's the Sandini Shakti hitting the Maya Shakti. All right, then you have the Samvit or Gyan. When it hits the Chit Shakti, again it manifests in full, and it manifests all the spiritual moods, all the different moods, all the different sti bhavs, the sense of being Krishna's mother or Krishna's... Krishna's friend, or having a relationship of laughter or ghastliness. Right, all the different spiritual emotions, all the anubhavas and the vibhavas, that's all coming from the Sanvit potency interacting with the Chit potency. When the Sanvit potency interacts with the Jiva Shakti, we get knowledge of God. We actually understand. Ah, oh, there's Krishna. Right, Rajavidya, Rajavidya. Pavitramidimutimam prachakshavagamam dharmam susukam kartamam prachakshavagamam dharmam. If you directly perceive this knowledge of God, Tesham evanu kamfartam aham agyana jantamahan asayam yatmabhavastho jnana jitmi vashvatam. When knowledge of God manifests in the heart, that's the Samvit Shakti interacting with the Jiva Shakti. Now, when the Samvit Shakti interacts, that's again minutely. When the Samvit Shakti interacts with the Maya Shakti, again, that's a reflection. And what does that show up as? Bhaktivinoda says, our worries. Oh, what am I going to do? I don't know if I'm going to have enough money. The bill collector just called again. You know, I'm already 32 and I'm still not married. I wonder if I'm going to find somebody. You know, I'm already 42 and I still don't have a baby, or whatever, you know. Am I going to pass this exam? When I visit Bhaktivedanta Manor, where we have a huge Indian congregation, certain times of the year, you're going to find a lot of young people in the temple room just like fervently praying. What's going on? I have an exam tomorrow. And what they'll even do, they bring their exam results in an envelope, and they... I don't know why they do this. I haven't gotten this one. You know, and they put it in front of the deities. I'm like, make it turn into an A, you know? So I haven't quite got that one. It's a little late. So our worries, you know what the biggest worry is? That I'm going to run out of money before I run out of life. That's people's biggest worry. Our hopes, our speculations, our general material thoughts. Why isn't this person here? I guess they don't like me. I always knew they didn't like me. Well, look at that person. Oh, they really like me. Look at that. I know this is going to happen. That's going to happen. So that's all the Samvit Shakti interacting with Maya Shakti. So that's a reflection. It's just a reflection of the spiritual emotions. Then the Ladini Shakti, when it interacts with the Chit Shakti, again has full expression. And that is prema. Now, not only prema, but because this Ladini Shakti is Kriya Shakti, action, it's all the varieties of loving exchanges. As you're saying, Prabhupada would often say that variety is the mother of enjoyment. I remember in our old school, we had a book about a family in Africa, and they ate millet for breakfast, and they ate millet for lunch, and they ate millet for dinner. 365 days a year, except when it was mango season, and then they also had some mangoes. And you could just imagine if you had basically one food that you ate every day for every meal. And so as soon as people become wealthy, they have a variety of food, just like one of the evidences of the wealth of we Americans is that you can go to the supermarket and there's so much food. You could hardly even catalog all of it. And all of the variety. When the Ladini Shakti interacts with the Jiva Shakti, it manifests just minutely. And there it manifests spiritual bliss. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says this includes bliss also of Paramatma and Brahman. It's not only the bliss of interacting with Bhagavan. Then when the Ladini Shakti interacts with Maya Shakti, there's just a reflection. And this is the two categories of material happiness. Bodily happiness, not, you know, having a comfortable temperature, having soft clothing, sexual enjoyment, nice food, something that pleasant music, beautiful scenery, having, you know, an ocean view with waving coconut trees. And, like when we were at Kona. So there they see the sun setting into the ocean. And where we are here, we see the sun rising over the ocean. So that's gross sense gratification, right? Watching the sun rise over the ocean, listening to nice, smelling. When I take a morning walk every day, unless it's pouring. And I'll walk up and down the street, and somebody has a tuberose tree, someone else has a gardenia tree, somebody else has a honeysuckle bush. Right? So it's gross happiness, smelling the gardenias, eating the mangoes, watching the sunrise, listening to nice music, sexual pleasure, temperature, nice clothing, soft beds. So that's one kind of happiness. And the other kind of happiness is what Bhaktivinoda Thakura calls swarga, heavenly happiness. That's subtle happiness. That's having people who love you, have a loving relationship with them, having intellectual stimulation, mental stimulation on the subtle platform. So there are two kinds of happiness, of the physical gross senses and of the subtle mind. Those are subtle mind intelligence and the material emotions. Both those sorts of happiness are the Ladini Shakti interacting with the Maya Shakti. So, you know, we have obviously a matrix here of nine different manifestations of the Lord's potency. And of course, we can understand by looking at this matrix, how much am I interacting with either the Chit potency or the Maya potency? Because being Jiva Shakti is also called Tattva Shakti. I'm right at the border. I'm kind of like that part of the sand that's sometimes dry and sometimes wet. Right? Sometimes dry and sometimes wet. So what do we want to be? Do we want to, you know, if you move too far, if you move up past where the tides come in, then you're always dry. And if you move further on into the ocean, you're always wet. So where do we stand? You know, many of us starting to practice spiritual life, we're sort of sometimes wet. The tide comes in, right? And then, the tide goes out. One time devotee said to Prabhupada, sometimes we fall into Maya. He said, no, you're usually in Maya. Sometimes we fall into Krishna. Some of us may be on a... When we were going to Coconut Island, we were going over the bridge, and there was a part of the bridge that was wet. And I thought, wow, it must not be very often that the water comes up that high. So some of us are so far up on the sand that, you know, we don't get wet very often. And other people are so far into the water they don't get dry very often. And others are, well, then I'm starting to steal somebody else's now. So some of the jivas are at either of those places. But we can look here and see, under what energy have I taken shelter? Because we can't stay without a shelter. We're marginal. You know, what kind of sandini, samvid, and ladini am I experiencing? Am I experiencing my real spiritual name and form, or am I experiencing that I'm Sam Smith or Julie Jones? And I'm blonde, or I'm redhead, and I have blue eyes. And, you know, what am I experiencing? What am I experiencing as far as my mental processes? Am I experiencing spiritual moods? Like Prahlad Maharaj, you know, Krishna would go away, he'd see Krishna going away, and he would cry, and Krishna would come, and he would laugh. Or am I worrying about how much money I have in the bank? And whether or not my hair is falling out, and whether or not my wife's going to have a decent meal cooked for me, or whatever it is. And what's my source of pleasure? Is my source of pleasure love for Krishna and the varieties of Krishna's activities? Or is my source of pleasure the interaction of my gross senses or the interaction of my mind? So we can look a little bit also about how Krishna displays his different potencies. And Krishna lifting Govardhan Hill, that's a nice display of Krishna's potencies. Just with one little finger. And Krishna's potencies are displayed so playfully. I really like that lila because it gives a little insight into Krishna's very playful nature. I mean, here's a flood coming. So Krishna can do anything. He could just dry up the flood, right? He could drink the water. After all, he drank fire. Even with Agastya Muni drank an ocean. So sure, Krishna could have just drunk all the water. He could have just thought, hey, I want it to be dried up. It would be dried up. He could have done what Chaitanya Muni did and paralyze Indra's arm. Just paralyze everything. You know that story, right? Indra was really angry that Chaitanya Muni gave the Aswini Kumaras the right to drink Somaras. So he was going to kill them. And Chaitanya Muni just parallels Indra's throwing arm. And he just couldn't throw his thunderbolt to kill the Aswini Kumaras, and he had to strike a deal with Chaitanya Muni. So Krishna could have done that. He could have just somehow taken away Indra's potency. But he didn't. He allowed Indra to do his whole thing. And he lifts up a mountain. I mean, is that how you deal with a flood? Very creative. So not only Krishna's strength, you know, he's apparently 7 years old and he lifts a mountain. I mean, I can't lift anything with just a little finger. Oh, look at that. I lifted my recorder cover. I mean, what can I lift? And I certainly couldn't hold it for 7 days and 7 nights without eating. So, you know, Krishna's lifting a whole mountain. So not only is he very strong, he's strong with a very delicate body. He's not like these, you know, Mr. Universes kind of guys. But look how clever and playful he is. I mean, how much fun he has dealing with the flood in that way. And everybody comes under like this umbrella. Of course, it was also a way for him to be with all the residents of Vrindavan. And Krishna's potency that is manifest in his name and in his form. And what an amazing potency. You know, if you have just a picture of your mother on your desk, you might think about her when you see the picture, but she's not there in the picture. You can't talk to the picture. You know, but as soon as there's a picture of Krishna, he's there. As soon as there's a manifestation of Krishna's form, according to the Shastra, he's there. So what you say is name, Krishna. Therefore, Rupa Goswami said, we don't know how much nectar is in these two syllables, Krishna. Who's that? I think it was Prithu, who said that the Lord said, what benediction would you like? He said, may I please have millions of ears? Can you imagine being in front of God? What would you like? Millions of ears. Because he felt that the nectar in Krishna's name couldn't be contained in his two ears. So what kind of amazing potency is that? That just by saying Krishna's name, everything manifests. And Krishna's potencies of expansion. How Krishna can have, we were talking about how Krishna has one potency for each of his devotees that particularly attracts us. So Krishna also has a very individual reciprocation with each devotee. I mean, in one sense, we can delineate the process of bhakti. We can say, okay, it's Adushraddha, and then Sadhu Sangha, and then Bhajana Kriya, and Arthanivritti. It goes from, you know, offensive chanting to clearing to pure chanting, or it goes from Kanista to Majjhima to Uttama in the degrees of faith or in degrees of relationship or in initiation. I think I've so far identified 18 different ways that the process of bhakti is described. But you know what? It's really a little individual for each of us. My journey to bhakti and your journey to bhakti and your journey to bhakti, guess what? It's ours. We each have a little individual path, and Krishna's relating with us. And he's doing that, of course, even with the conditioned souls, he's relating with them. He's relating individually. What to speak of his pure devotees? And he's so expert at this, Kapiladeva says this, that the Lord manifests a form according to the desire of the devotees, that each devotee thinks Krishna's just with me and I'm Krishna's favorite. Hey, just think about this for a minute. So, there you are in the rasa dance. There's billions and billions and billions of other gopis. And you're looking around and there's all these concentric circles and there's billions of gopis and Krishna's only dancing with you. It's amazing, isn't it? So that's Krishna's potency. Right, the cowherd boys are also, they're sitting in concentric circles. I think Krishna's just looking at me. Even though there's billions and billions and billions of cowherd boys. And each queen is thinking, Krishna, you know, my co-wives, they never get to see their husband. They don't feel too sorry for the money. They're thinking, Krishna's just in my house. That is another one of his potencies. But this tattva is that Krishna's still independent. He's still independent. Hey, although you take the complete away, still the complete remains. So each of his energies are complete, and yet Krishna is still complete. All right, now if I'm one of Krishna's energies, and everything I'm dealing with is Krishna's energy, then how can I deal with myself and my life so that I realize this truth? I mean, almost anybody with a little bit of work and time and effort could memorize this sloka, or at least memorize the English list, and then you could say, I know it, like the Christians have some kind of catechism like that, right, where you just say, okay, here's my list, this is what I believe. That's how you become a Muslim, you know. You just say, I believe that Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet. Okay, you're a Muslim. I know some devotees who did that in Muslim countries and they were left alone. They said, yes, Allah is God and Muhammad is his prophet. Okay, fine. And I've also had this experience dealing with some Christians when they were really harassing me when I was at a book distribution. I said, I accept Jesus as my guru, as my savior. Okay, then they had nothing more to say. They were done. When the discussion was over, they weren't trying to convert me anymore. So this is these This dasmulatattva is not just a statement of belief. I believe that God has multipotencies. I believe that he's not impotent. But it's something that we're supposed to realize. Now, this is something that we can each realize, even to some extent, even if we're just beginners. Even if I think, well, you know, my consciousness is mostly that I'm this body, and I just see the material world, and I chant the Hare Krishna mantra, and it just sounds to me like letters of the alphabet, and I eat prasadam, and I just think it's food. You know, I'm really on this like gross neophyte level. How am I going to appreciate that? Remember in the beginning I was talking about how we appreciate our own energies? I mean, we do, don't we? Doesn't everybody do that? When you say something really clever, don't you delight in that? That's what happened to me at the library. I said something really clever, and I was like, yes, I am smart. Right? When you create something really nice, you're like, yes, look what I can do. So guess what? Guess whose energy that is? It's Krishna. Krishna says, I'm the ability in man. I'm the strength of the strong. I'm the intelligence of the intelligent. So it's not that we stop delighting in it. It's not that we go, no, I didn't say anything clever at all. But instead of just delighting in it as Kartahami Dimanite, I'm the doer. Wow. How wonderful to be cooperating with Krishna, to be connecting with Krishna, to have Krishna use me to do this, to have Krishna work through me. That's what Krishna wants. By the way, Krishna doesn't want us to work with him like we're a computer. My computer doesn't cooperate with me. It doesn't wake up in the morning and say, I can't wait till Urmila pushes that power button so I can cooperate with her. It doesn't have any will.
It doesn't even cooperate otherwise.
But it doesn't have any will. It doesn't have any thinking, feeling, and willing. So when I'm using my energy through the computer, it's actually I don't really have some sort of a relationship with the computer. I don't have some sort of any kind of relationship with the computer. So at least not a satisfying one if I have any. So that's not what Krishna wants us to be. He doesn't want us to be some sort of machine. In fact, it said that Krishna doesn't enjoy the material energy. You think about what does that mean? Krishna doesn't get any pleasure from things that are dead. What he gets pleasure from is relationships. So Krishna wants us to be an active give and take, that I'm opening myself up and saying, yes, Lord, use me. I'm volunteering. Here I am, you know, reporting for duty. How would you like to use me today? How can I work with you? Something like a dance. Prabhupada says the whole world is full of Krishna singing and dancing. Something like a dance. What is when you're dancing with somebody, you respond to the other. Or when you're singing with someone, like we were singing, playing instruments, right? You're responding to each other. So somebody's leading, but the instrument, it's going back and forth. Or if you've ever seen a dance where the dancer is responding to the drum player, have you ever seen a Bharatanatyam and Chim dance like that? Where the dancer plays a certain rhythm with their bells and then the drummer responds and they go back and forth with particular rhythms. So that's very nice, don't you enjoy seeing that? Mm-hmm. Right? That kind of back and forth. And in our human relationships, that's the kind of relationship we would like to have. Unfortunately, we don't always have it. That's the kind of relationship we'd like to have with our spouse, with our children, with our siblings, with our friend. That kind of where we're individual, but we're in sync. Mm-hmm. And we're leading and following and leading and following and working in a harmonious way. So when we see these energies that Krishna manifests to us, we can delight in them as a way that we're reciprocating with Krishna, to appreciate his energies and to appreciate Krishna's potencies in the material creation. Right? Bhumirapanalovayam kamana buddhevacha. To appreciate Krishna as this earth, water, fire, air, ether, that Krishna is also our mind, our intelligence. How wonderful even that he's our false ego. Pretty amazing, this false ego, isn't it? We can appreciate it. Krishna has developed such an amazing false ego that I actually believe that I'm a white American woman. Pretty funny. And in another life, I believed I was, you know, an Indian man or a Chinese man or a whale. And I thought, I'm a whale. And I believed it. That's pretty amazing. They haven't yet, you know, perfected this in the movie industry. They're trying with the 3D, and that will be the perfection, you know, the video games, if they can really hook you up and you actually believe, I am now become Harry Potter. You have to pay a lot of money for those tickets. So we can appreciate how wonderful Krishna's energy is, how wonderful even his Maya Shakti is. And start with that. Right? The beginners can at least appreciate the universal form of the Lord. We can also appreciate, this is tricky, Krishna's potency in other jivas. Generally, when we see Krishna's potency in other jivas, we conditioned souls become
envious.
Oh, how come that person can sing better than I can? Why is that person a better cook than I am? Why are they a better speaker than I am? Why do they have better memory? Ah, that Shravan, he knows that Sanskrit. I pronounce it like a bludgeon. You know? But usually we become envious. So in this spiritual world, everybody is appreciating. That's the main component. The main difference, by the way, between the internal potency and the external potency is in the external potency we're envious, and in the internal potency we're appreciative. Prabhupada said there's actually very little difference between material and spiritual consciousness. And said, but, you know, two parallel lines, just a tiny little difference, and you end up all the way over there. So the tiny little difference is appreciation. That's the cure for envy. How wonderful. Now, that appreciation can inspire you. You can say, wow, that person can recite the verses so nicely. Maybe I'll sit down and I'll learn how to do that so Krishna can be pleased with me too. But there's no envy. I don't want to have it at the other person's expense. It's not that I want to excel them to put them down. So that's another way of really understanding Krishna's omnipotency. How Krishna has given everyone, Prabhupada said, some extraordinary talent. Everyone has some extraordinary talent. Look for it. Glorify it. How wonderful Krishna's empowered you. And not only devotees, Krishna's empowered all kinds of, every living entity. Even bugs. Right? Even the frogs, even the cookie frogs. He's empowered them. They have a certain shakti, they have a certain energy. How wonderful it is. So, and to take actually delight. You know, we're all Anandamaya Vyasat. We're getting our happiness from somewhere. Krishna has this Ladini Shakti. Where are we finding our delight? Our delight should be how wonderful Krishna is. How wonderful that Krishna is working through me. How wonderful that Krishna is working through another jiva. And asking for Krishna's potency to do whatever we're going to do. One of my favorite stories in this regard is that of Bhima. I've probably told this story here before. So when Krishna had got, I don't know how far to go back in the story, so Krishna got a message that there were tens of thousands of kings imprisoned by Jarasandha, and he assured them that he would free them. And then it was decided by the advice of Uddhava that freeing those kings would go along with the Rajasuya sacrifice that would establish Yudhisthira as emperor, because all the subordinate kings had to pay tribute. And Jarasandha, who was imprisoning those kings, definitely would not pay tribute. They'd have to have a fight. In the fight, they could defeat Jarasandha, and they could release the kings. Or if Jarasandha did pay tribute, then he could also release the kings. So that was the plan. And Bhima was designated to fight with Jarasandha. I'm not going to go into all the details. They went to Jarasandha's capital. Krishna's standing right there. Bhima is fighting with Jarasandha under Krishna's direction, with Krishna right there. And what's happening? He's just getting nowhere. For how many days? 28 days. Somehow that seems to, they like to do it for a month. Yeah. Jambavan also fought with Krishna for a month. So a whole month's going by, and Bhima, who's one of the strongest people on the planet, he's fighting with this Jarasandha, he's getting nowhere. Nobody's defeating anybody. They're just equal. And Krishna's standing there the whole time. You know, sometimes we think, well, if I've gotten an order from Guru, I've gotten an order from Krishna, it's in the Shastra, and Krishna's right next to me, of course I'm going to be immediately successful. It didn't work that way for Bhima. And Krishna's watching. Finally, Bhima says, Na shaktoham jarasandham nirjetam yudhimalva. So this is about Krishna's shaktiman. Na shaktoham aham. I don't have the shakti. Na shaktoham jarasandham nirjetam yudhimalva. O Madhava. Nirjetam. Jeta's like jaya. I can't get victory, yudhi, in battle with jarasandha, O Madhava. I don't have the strength. I don't have the energy. I can't do it. I don't have the potency. And then Krishna did two things. Abhyayam swena tejasa. Tejas means power. He gave him swena, he gave him swa, his own. He gave Bhima his own power. And then he gave him a hint. He didn't just say, do it like this. He took a blade of grass and just tore it in two. Okay. And then Bhima was successful. So this is another way in which we can remember that Krishna is the Shaktiman and I am Shakti. To go to Krishna and ask him, do my best to follow the orders of Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. Do my best to follow the orders of the Lord. And always remember, I can't really do anything. And to go to the Lord, na shaktoham jarasandham nirjetam yudhimalva, abhyayam swena tejasa, you please give me your potency. You fill me with your shakti. And if you don't fill me with your, I can't do anything. Like Arjuna, after Krishna left the planet, he couldn't do anything. He couldn't even string his Gandiva bow anymore. He was just taking the bow and hitting the bad guys over the head. And even that didn't work. They got away from him. Arjuna, who'd never known defeat, practically speaking, unless you want to count Yudhisthira's gambling match. You know, Arjuna never known defeat. In fact, single-handedly, he had knocked out the whole Kuru army when they were in Virat. And yet he couldn't deal with a bunch of coward men when Krishna withdrew his potency. So we ask Krishna for the potency to do everything. I know some devotees, we're constantly doing that for everything. Constantly remembering everything I'm doing, walking, drinking water, seeing, speaking, I'm getting that potency from Krishna. Thank you, Lord. Let me use this for your service. If we always remember I'm getting this potency from Krishna, then what are we going to do with it? And finally, I want to think a little bit about what kind of Shakti we are. We're called Prakriti. Krishna is the Purusha, and we're Prakriti. A wonderful thing I was reading from Srila Prabhupada the other day was saying how the word love is usually used in reference to the relationship between man and woman. And because Krishna is a supreme man and we are all female, therefore, to use the word love of God to speak about the relationship between Krishna and the living entities is very appropriate. So if we think about what is feminine energy? What is the ultimate or symbolic expression of feminine energy? It's receptivity. The feminine is receptive. The feminine is what receives the seed that opens to give birth. It's a very receptive, open kind of energy. The masculine is much more doing energy. So what we are called to do as Krishna's Shakti is to be receptive. So we know about thinking, feeling, and willing. We all know what it means to have an open mind, right? Everybody knows what it means to have an open mind. So open mind means you're willing to consider things out of your paradigm, out of your worldview. So those of us who grew up in materialistic culture and took to Krishna consciousness, we had to have a very open mind. Now, I was brought up with the concept that we all evolve from apes. I remember sitting in a Bhagavatam class soon after I moved into the ashram, and the speaker was talking about how there was one sun in the universe. So I raised my hand, I said, don't you mean the solar system? So an open mind, maybe things aren't exact, maybe they don't fit into all of my preconceived patterns. You know about psychological experiments, about how we have preconceived patterns? Are you familiar with any of those? So it's one very, very famous experiment where any of you familiar with the card experiment? No? You are. All right, so there was one very famous experiment where the researchers took a deck of cards. You know there's four suits in a deck of cards, right? There's red hearts, there's red diamonds, there's black spades, and there's black clubs. So then they put some what we call weird cards in there. They put like black hearts and red clubs, and they mixed them in with the other cards. They showed the cards very quickly to people, and when they were showing them very quickly, when people would see these weird cards, they'd identify them as if they were a regular card. If they saw a black heart, they might say it was a club or it was a heart. And they started slowing down the rate at which they showed the cards, and at a certain point people would start going, huh? What's that? And at a certain point most people would say, wait a minute, something's funny there. But 25% of the people never recognized the strange cards, no matter how slowly they were shown. Now, if you don't believe this, there's a video you can find on the internet called something about the invisible gorilla. And half the people who watch that video don't see the gorilla.
Spoiled it now.
I spoiled it for you, sorry. You can show it to a friend of yours. It's a people passing a basketball. Half of them are wearing white, half of them are wearing black. And they say, watch this video and count the number of times the ball is being passed by the people in the white. So you're focused on the people in the white and you're watching the ball being passed and you're counting it. And right in the middle, somebody walks in wearing a black gorilla costume, stands in the middle, goes, and then walks off. 50% of people never see the gorilla. At the end, they say, did you see the gorilla? The what? The gorilla. There was a gorilla. The what? And people are amazed. How could I have not seen the gorilla? Because it doesn't fit into your categories. So open mind means that maybe there's something beyond my categories. Maybe my view of the universe is not the view of the, is not actually reality. That we all have this as our philosophy, that we have imperfect senses, right? We are tend to be illusions, but we tend to think that applies to everybody else. You have imperfect senses and you can be illusion, but me, you know, what I see, what I understand is the way it is. So open mind, that my interpretation of reality is probably different from reality. Right? In psychology, they say the map is not the territory. What I have in my head is a map. So that's one way that we can be receptive as Krishna's prakriti. I don't know everything. My understanding of things may be different from what they are. So that's open mind, thinking. Then feeling, open heart. To have an open heart. This relates to Krishna's verse in the 6th chapter that one should see everyone suffering according to oneself. One should have empathy. We tend to think, you know, it's me and you over there. We get very much caught up in our own feelings and our own way of looking at things. So one other way that we can act as Krishna's energy is to have an open heart. To understand that everybody's looking for Krishna. Everybody's looking for Krishna. And everyone's trying to find Krishna. It's just that most conditioned souls are really looking in the wrong place. That's all. They're going to a fabric store looking for watermelon and it just isn't there. But they're looking for the real deal. They're just looking for it in the wrong way or in the wrong place. That in one sense, everyone is like me. We're each individuals, of course, but we're all the same. We all want eternality, knowledge, and bliss, and loving relationships, and everything that everyone does is only for that. It doesn't matter what they do. Even the most cruel, heinous, evil person, what are they looking for? They're looking for eternity, knowledge, and bliss, and loving relationships. They're looking ultimately for yoga. They're looking for connection with life. That's what everyone's looking for. And when you open your heart, like, it's amazing how Krishna can use us when we open our heart like that. Unbelievable. So, of course, people involved in psychology and counseling do this to some extent. But when you're connected with Krishna and see how everyone's really looking for Krishna, that's the only time you can have a full open heart. And then finally, thinking, feeling, and willing, an open will. Like Jesus said, thy will be done. I'm willing to understand that the way I see the world is an ultimate reality. That other people have feelings and needs just like me. And they're all looking for Krishna too. And to have real empathy with them. And then to make myself available, make my will in harmony with Krishna. Again, not as a machine. Krishna does not want machines. He's not interested in machines. Now, his ultimate abode is a village, not even a city. Krishna does not want us to become a robot without will. He wants us to use our will in harmony with him, just like a dance. Where I open up my will and I'm allowing him to direct my life through guru, through sadhu, through shastra. Even when I don't understand. So ordinary people do this. Ordinary people do this in school, right? You sit in your college class and you have no idea why you're being taught what you're being taught and what you're going to do with it. And you open your will to the teacher, to the university. People do it in the military. Well, they don't understand. Why am I ordered to do this? And they do it. People do it in their business. So we open our will to Krishna. Not that we have to see the whole plan. All I need to know is what I'm going to do now. Let Krishna be the general. Let Mahaprabhu be the general. You know, I can be a foot soldier. I don't even have to be a foot soldier. I can be a support person cooking for the foot soldiers. I don't need to know the whole battle plan. I don't need to know the whole strategy. I don't need to be a big shot. But I can open my will. So that's how I act properly as Krishna's energy. Open mind, open heart, open will. That's how I act as Prakriti, as feminine energy. And guess what happens when you do that?
Krishna's attractive.
Krishna's very attractive. And then it's explained, like Dhruva Maharaj, that when the unit energy becomes in harmony with the total energy, then the unit energy acts as the total energy. Once we open our mind, our heart, and our will to the Supreme, once we act fully as Prakriti, then guess what? We can also act. The Shaktiman acts through us. And then you instantly know how to act. Once you've opened your mind, your heart, and your will, then everything becomes clear. Often we try to find everything clear without doing that. We try to find everything clear just on the material platform, but then where are we in this chart? Then we're in the Samvit Maya Shakti, the worries, the hopes, the speculations, and the thoughts. Right? Or we're the Maya Shakti Sandini. Well, let's see, if I'm a white American woman, I should behave like this. If I'm, you know, a rich person, I should behave like this. If I'm an ISKCON member, I should behave like this. And then that's the level that we're operating on. Whereas if we're actually open and receptive, then we immediately can get full direction, how to act, how to behave. And then we also exhibit that Shakti. So, I'm going to stop here. We could talk about Krishna as a Shakti man for a long time. I'll just end the questions. It's late, right? We could have 5 minutes. Yes?
So, I guess, does it all go back to being humble then? Because if you're open minded, then you must be humble or if you're humble, you must be open minded because then you're like, oh, I'm not now, I think I'm humble and I'm going to ask, teach me.
Yes. Definitely. Humility is a synonym for honesty.
What?
Honesty.
Sincerity.
I don't know. I think of sincerity as a little nuanced. Because I could be sincere without yet having become humble at all. You know, I think of the first measure of sincerity. Well, okay, let's say you wanted to teach somebody mridanga, and you said, we're going to have lessons Thursday at 6:30. What would be the first measure of their sincerity? They show up. So they might not be humble at all, but at least they show up. So I think, you know, there's levels of sincerity that can be there. You show up, you do what you're asked to do. You put some effort in, but humility is honesty. That's really, I don't see any difference between humility and honesty.
But just to show up, you've got to be somewhat sincere and somewhat humble, because you're showing up there for one reason, to take instruction.
To take instruction. All right, there you go, defeated.
Yeah, I have a question. Yeah. So in the list that you gave us,
yes,
there's Chit Shakti, Jiva Shakti, and Maya Shakti.
Yes.
So I can understand under Jiva how this, on the Sandini section, it says Jiva's spiritual existence. So that's like the completion of the Jiva's journey.
Yes.
And then under Samvit, it's a little confusing because it says knowledge of God, but it doesn't seem to bring that to a conclusion. Whereas under Haladini, it has spiritual bliss, which the jiva can go up to some level of praying. So I'm just thinking that under knowledge of God, I think I read somewhere that the knowledge of God turns into spiritual moods. So that, in that sense, that's like a completion. I'm just thinking that that's not quite complete.
Well, that would seem to make sense, because if you take, because jiva shakti is tatastha shakti, has to actually go one way or the other.
Yeah.
So in all those things in the Jiva Shakti, their completion would be once the Jiva Shakti is under the shelter of the Chit Shakti.
Yes. Yeah, so
and that's for all
like
of that, those.
Yeah, it just seems like it needs to be complete for all those, so that the Jiva can manifest as full.
Yes, potency. Yes, that's a very good point. I mean, even if you look at Sandini Shakti, our spiritual existent name and place only finds completeness when we're using that in Krishna's pastimes, which is over at the level of the Chit Shakti. So, and our knowledge of God is only complete when we're exhibiting spiritual moods.
Right.
And our spiritual bliss is only complete when we're exhibiting prema and variety of activities. So thank you. That's very nice. Thank you. Tushyanti cha, ramanti cha. Let's go for it.
Also, Radharani has always suggested, I mean, we're talking about Kundalini Shakti here, to be not just Kundalini Shakti, but both Samvit and Kundalini.
Yes, well, ultimately, the Swarup Shakti, which encompasses everything, is Srimati Radharani. So we can say that all of Krishna's Shaktis are Srimati Radharani. And yet you can say Srimati Radharani is the Kundalini Shakti. And Balaram is the Sandini Shakti and Samvit Shakti. So that's...
But my point is that the conclusion of Chit Shakti has to be Ladini.
Has to be Ladini, yes. Yes, yes.
One more chapter?
Yes.
So even, like the classification, like, oh, it is kind of Ladini or something like that, is a material destination, yeah? I mean...
Certainly can be. I think often is.
Because...
It doesn't have to be, but it often is.
Well, I'm not in this kind of really can be a material.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, what's really interesting about this, and I must confess that I have not read the whole book of the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, whatever it is. I never read the whole book. But my godbrother, Sridhar Maharaj, asked me to read one chapter of it, I think chapter two. So I did read it. I think I read it twice. And it's where Stephen Covey talks about what's the center of your life. And the center of your life could be money. The center of your life could be friends and enemies. By the way, I know some people where the center of their life is friends and enemies. They base everything around, are you my friend or are you my enemy? They're constantly in some kind of battle. The center of your life could be your spouse. The center of your life could be family. Let's see if I can remember all of them. Your work, your career. Now, his idea is that the highest center is principles, or dharma. That's what he gives as the highest center. But one of his centers is church. Now, he's a religious person. He's a Mormon. So he certainly feels you should go to a church. But he equates having a church-centered life with having a money-centered life, or having a family-centered life. And he considers they're all below a principle-centered life. So my son Keshava was arguing with me one time, which is very unusual. So anyway, we were arguing one time, and he was saying, Mata, you're not really God-centered, you're actually church-centered. And I said, no, I'm not. I'm Krishna-centered. How dare you say I'm church-centered? He said, look, Just have an open mind and read Covey's definition of a church-centered person. And then he said, don't think it's something bad. You know, don't think that I'm blaming you. And just read it and see if it applies to you. And I read it and I kind of came back with my tail between my legs and I said, yeah. So it is very possible that a person can mistake some material designation for something spiritual, or something spiritual for something material. It happens all the time. So I don't think you can say for a particular person, if they say, I'm a member of this organization, that that's necessarily a material or spiritual designation. But I wouldn't assume that it's material, and I wouldn't assume that it's spiritual.
Well,
is it
technically a connotation
with,
oh, I'm in a scumbag, I'm not in a scumbag, that's just
a
material name, really, right?
That depends on you.
It depends on what
you That depends on you. You know, now they're not going to teach it anymore, but for 3 or 4 years, I taught a course on ISKCON history at Bhaktivedanta College in Radhadesh, and which was a difficult course to teach, which I never let anybody record it. But what I start out with is that when you're looking at a spiritual organism, or looking at an organization, you can relate to it on different levels. And the organization actually exists on each of those levels. And how you perceive it will determine what you're getting out of that organization. So if you see that this, and I don't care whether it's ISKCON or something else. I mean, someone just sent me some clips from Brother Sun Sister Moon about St. Francis, who worked with the Catholic Church. And he decided that although he was doing something that was sort of opposed to what was happening in the church, that he was going to work within the church boundaries. He wasn't going to go outside and form his own organization. So one way you can see a religious organization is as a material business. It's a place where people get status and position and money and power, and it's made up of buildings, and it's not that much different from, you know, IBM. And I'll tell you that all organizations do also exist on that level. That's not false. And if you go into the organization and you think it's that kind of an organization, that's how you'll interpret what's happening. That's how you'll perceive everything. You'll see this person's doing that to get money and power. This person's doing that to get position. And that's how you'll do things. You'll think, well, how can I behave to get a position? Well, if I come to Mangalartik every day and chant 16 rounds every day, then I'll be able to get, you know, I'll be able to stay in the ashram, and I'll be able. And Jiva Goswami speaks about if one intentionally is inattentive in one's chanting, that one will start to identify one's advancement in terms of one's external accomplishments. You know, well, I'm very advanced because I offered 10,000 RTs, and I'm very advanced because I distributed 5,000 books, and I'm very so. An organization operates at that level. Then another level that a religious organization can operate at is to be a place for mundane dharma, mode of goodness dharma. So at least speaking for ISKCON, a lot of people deal with it that way, especially many members of our Indian congregation. This is a place where I can come and do my ritualistic dharma, and I can say the prayers that I learned when I was a child, and I can eat the cultural food that I was brought up in, and this is where I can do my religion. So I can be pious, and then I can go to heaven. You know, whether they're thinking of heaven as Swarga or Vaikuntha, it doesn't really matter. That's their mood. I want to be a pious person. And they see what happens in the religious organization in that way. They interpret what happens in terms of this person is following their piety and their dharma or not. And I know many members of this kind who operate on that level. It depends on your perspective. Then you might see a religious organization as, well, this is a vehicle for my own personal spiritual development. I don't want to do it alone. I don't want to live in a cave in the Himalayas. I want to have some sangha. And this is where I can get sangha to facilitate my advancement. It's a vehicle for my advancement. Or a combination of that, one could see this is a vehicle for my preaching. This is a vehicle for my service to my guru. It's an instrument I'm using. So it's an instrument for my advancement. It's an instrument for service to my guru, or a combination of those. Or one could see it as this is a branch of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's Sankirtan movement. This is where Mahaprabhu is having his lila in this building. Mahaprabhu is having his lila in this particular sangha. And by participating in this sangha with these Vaishnavas, I'm participating in Mahaprabhu's lila. Now, I'll tell you, if you see like that, you're going to see the different people in the Sangha very differently. Okay, you're going to interpret their behavior very differently. You're going to interpret your behavior very differently. Now, I don't know that many people who function on that level. I've met some. That's in the minority. And most people I see function at the other level. So especially if you're functioning at the mundane dharma or business level, then definitely being church-centered is a material designation. If you're functioning at the other levels, then it's not. And I'm sure there's many other ways of analyzing it. That's the analysis that I've personally found helpful. And I can think, why am I doing something? Why am I doing what I'm doing? Am I doing this to impress other people so that they'll give me, you know, a samosa? Everybody else gets the khichdi, but I'll get the samosa. Do you follow what I'm saying? Why am I doing it? What's driving me? That takes also quite a bit of honesty. What's pushing me? Am I doing it because I'm envious of that person and I want to show that I'm better than them? Am I doing it for some material security? So I have a place to stay and food to eat? You know, am I doing it for prestige?
So it's intent and perspective.
Yes, it's intent and perspective. Sorry, I was off. Could have just said that. It would have been an easy answer instead of going, what did you want to say?
Well, I just remembered that the meaning of ISKCON and how Prabhupada based that on that verse.
Of Rupa Goswami.
Rupa Goswami, Kirtan, I can't remember the verse right now.
Rasa Bhavitamati. Krishna.
Krishna, Rasa
Bhavitamati.
Prabhupada, like, based the meaning of ISKCON, the what he wanted it to mean and what he wanted it to be, on the verse of Sri Rupa Goswami, which is like the definition of any devotee could say that they're ISKCON if they're following Rupa Goswami, and following Mahaprabhu.
And that's obviously an understanding of ISKCON on one of those higher levels. So there's. Anyway, I've seen that there are people operating at each of those levels. And by the way, when people are operating at very different levels, if they try to talk to each other about what's going on, it doesn't work very well.
To say the least.
It really doesn't work very well. So if one person is seeing, you know, this sangha is a manifestation of Mahaprabhu's lila, and another person is thinking this is like IBM, and they try to talk about mission and vision, or they try to talk about what's going on, and it's like, you know, a Russian speaking to a Chinaman. Okay. I will thank you very, very much. Thank you for giving me a good excuse to study Bhakti Vinod.